thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 3 for the 4th of April, 2007, CI Cyber Infrastructure. I'm Dan Cohen, this week's host. Well, we're back once again for lucky podcast number 3. And I'm Dan Cohen, as you just heard in the introduction. And I'm here once again with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan. How are you today?
And I should say, as you can hear from Mills and Tom's crisp voice on the podcast this week, that we think we finally resolved all of our sound issues. We all have high-quality mics and high-speed networks, and so this podcast, I think, is going to sound considerably better than our first two. And as we said, I think in last week's podcast, we're learning each week, and we hope that you're learning along with us, and we've certainly learned a lot about sound and how to make it better, and so hopefully this will sound good when it receives when it gets to your downloads. We wanted to start, since yesterday was April Fool's. We are not going to do an April Fool's podcast, although some of what we say may sound ridiculous. But we did want to discuss a little bit. Tom Mills, did you hear any good April Fool's jokes in the area of digital humanities?
Well, I did notice that Google bought OCLC. That was kind of an interesting purchase for them.
Yeah, I saw this one online, and it had all the merits of a good April Fool's joke, because it was based in something that was believable. It could happen that Google might do that, and the people purveying the joke certainly made it seem a little believable. And so for a few minutes, I thought, wow, maybe they really did do that.
It's interesting this year, I don't know if the two of you noticed this, but so many of the jokes, the sort of tech and academic jokes from prior years that used to be about Microsoft and their world domination have now all become about Google buying people or merging with people or coming out with products. And I think it's just very telling that now Google is the kind of center of most of these April Fool's jokes.
So does that mean we should... Does that mean we should sell our Microsoft stock now?
I think we should have done that a long time ago, but it's probably a little too late for that. You know, and I think Google has done a good job, actually, with their own. Every year they always have pretty good April Fool's jokes, beginning with the pigeon rank scheme. I don't know if you remember that from a couple of years ago where they...
I sort of remember that.
They said that they had an army of pigeons sitting in a lab ranking web pages by pecking at keyboards. And then they, of course, had the famous... Google Moon Unit, where they were going to have a base on the moon, or was it Saturn or some other planet? But they actually had a pretty good one this year that was exactly what the joke that we were going to have on the Zotero site, which was they had on their Google Labs website something about how Google's coming up with a technology that writes your papers for you. And so it totally stole our joke. So we didn't end up posting it on the Zotero blog.
I mean, it is interesting, though. You know, I think this OCLC story originated on like an official American Library Association blog, and you know, it made the rounds of the web pretty quickly, to the point where I think some people who maintain blogs, respectable blogs in history, the humanities, library science, and other disciplines, picked up the story and ran with it without really reading the article to the end, to the point where they gave away the joke. And I think a lot of people really believe this. And it says something about the power of blogs and the kind of casualness of the medium, and how it affects the way professional and disciplinary news travels around.
Well, I think you're right, Tom, and it also shows how much easier it is to purvey hoaxes in the digital age than it used to be. I mean, there are a number of excellent hoax websites. The best one maybe is the Boilerplate site, which is the history of a Victorian era robot, which the website has the advantage of everything in the website is true except for the central premise, which is a lie. And it's very convincing in its design. It looks like a good history website. And if you're not careful, you could be taken in, as one of Jerry Seinfeld's writers was, who discussed it in a book of his about comedy, and he thought it was a spoof of a Victorian era robot. He didn't know that the whole thing was a spoof.
Yeah. And I also think just the velocity of the blogosphere. I mean, the problem I have now is if you really participate in this, in the blogosphere and you're reading all these things, they're found out so much faster too. I mean, you really have to try to get to sort of pull something over on other people, just be, with the number of eyes that are looking at these things. I remember there used to be pretty good April Fool's jokes that would really catch a lot of people, including ones about Microsoft, buying Apple and that sort of thing that sounded legitimate. And now I think people are more, they're trying too hard in a sense to make this stuff up. But anyway, we wanted to also mention, just as a follow-up to last week's or 2 weeks ago, we discussed YouTube, and in the interim, we've of course seen that News Corp and NBC and some of these big groups that see a lot of their content on YouTube are now banding together. I think the snickering comment of the week about this was that it was Me Too Tube rather than YouTube, but these big media organizations trying to come up with their own structure. And I suspect it's just not going to work because they won't be able to build the kind of community that YouTube already has. But it'll be interesting to see what. Is NBC News going to put up free content, or is this just entertainment content that'll go up on these sites, the SNLs, clips from SNL or something like that?
I mean, to some extent, these big media companies are already doing this. I mean, there is video content available on NBC's
That's
site,
true.
Fox News' site. I mean, CNN has tons of video content up there. It's streaming content. It's not in the cool Flash player that you can share and pass around, but it's already up there. I don't see what they're doing that's all that different. But who knows?
Well, I think there may also be. It may be a necessary step in future lawsuits as well, because if they've got a site where they're purveying their own content and then that same content shows up on YouTube, then they can show some sort of commercial harm
Right.
being caused by YouTube.
That's a great point. Plus, they
Oh, that
can
is
also show
interesting. Yeah, totally.
that they can filter out their site, which I assume is what the argument will hinge on, is that Google's going to argue there's no way that they can human, that's not humanly possible to vet everything that comes in through YouTube. And so if NBC and News Corp have a site where they are vetting everything, they can say, "Hey, look, we did it. Why can't you do it? You have all these math PhDs on your staff." So, I
Right,
think you're right. It is a good bargaining chip for
and
them.
isn't that what happened in the end with Napster? The judge didn't say that Napster had to close its doors. The judge said Napster had to come up with a way to filter its content of copyright material, and they couldn't come up with a way to do that.
Right.
And that's what
Exactly.
killed them.
Yep. Well, I guess we'll see what happens there. But I think that the kind of content there is probably not likely to have, the historical content that Mills mentioned. I think it's probably a lot less likely to go up on some big News Corp, NBC, whatever, Viacom site than it is on YouTube, where it seems like some of the footage you were talking about, Mills, was really, just bubbling up from the populace, people with video cameras and things like that. So I think probably a lot of that content will remain on YouTube. Well, we also saw in the past couple of weeks, speaking of lawsuits, and we'll try not to turn this podcast into all the all lawsuit edition, although inevitably some of these things come up. I think there's actually a very interesting lawsuit going on right now with the plagiarism company Turnitin. Those of you who don't know Turnitin, it's used by a lot of colleges and universities, as well as I think some K-12 school systems, to find
Yeah, and I
plagiarism.
think the
And
suit is a K-12
right,
K-12 suit.
that's right. The lawsuit, I think, including some students from our area, right, McLean,
That's right, Virginia.
Virginia, and they have sued Turnitin because the way Turnitin works is that they take papers that have been submitted to teachers and professors and add them to their database. So they, you know, take a text dump and stick it in their database. So their database continues to grow based on the work of all these hundreds of thousands or millions of students who are writing these, you know, term papers and so forth. So they're not only scanning content on the web to see if a paper matches any of that, they're also scanning existing papers in their database. And it really, you know, I thought about this early on. It just, you know, what about all these students who are essentially contributing to the value of this company through their papers? I mean, I understand why you'd want to do this, but I'm really surprised that there hasn't been a lawsuit up till this point.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking as somebody who actually uses this site with my own students, I completely agree with you. It is there. I think there's a real legal issue to be defined here. At the same time, whether it's the Turnitin model or some other model, there has to be some way for teachers to combat the sort of rampant plagiarism that's going on, made so easy by digital media. Since I started using Turnitin this semester for the first time, for where my students actually turn their work in through the project, and I have to say I've spent virtually no time wondering about the work that my students have turned in. It's so obviously their work and not work that they've copied from somewhere else. And so probably for the first semester in 5 or 6 years, I'm going to have no honor cases to submit at the end of the term. At least I hope that's the case.
Hmm. And have you ever had matches from the database that are copies from materials from students? In other words, it's not.
Sure. Sure.
You last, have, really.
Last semester I had two cases that I turned in. One was a match from a website which Turnitin identified. I was taking the student papers individually and submitting them through the system if I had some reason to suspect the paper, and instead of having all of the students turn in their papers this way. And then I had one student paper which came from a database of papers for sale on the internet. And uh-huh. And so, you know, both of those cases are in front of our honor committee right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, in some respects, this is the same issue that Google has to deal with.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, that there it's it and really any project that's based on this kind of wisdom of crowds model has to deal with these kinds of copyright issues. I wonder if a possible solution to it is if for students to have some kind of, you know, like no bots header on their paper, so that you know, like you can make your students hand in their paper through Turnitin, and Turnitin will check their paper to see if they're plagiarizing. But if they say to Turnitin, "I don't want you to save my paper," Turnitin won't actually add it to the ongoing database.
Right, but then you know, then their whole model is challenged, because then you know, if a lot of students opt out of adding their paper to the database, which I assume a lot would, just only to snicker at these adults who are trying to catch them, then, you know, you've got these papers that are sort of offline and out of the database, and they can be copied without an infraction being noticed. So I think there's a real serious issue here about it. And I'm surprised that they've kind of had a free pass on this. I do think you're right, Tom, that a lot of it has to do with the kind of copy first, ask questions later culture that Google really has to operate in. And it'll be interesting to see how this lawsuit plays out, especially with the mirror lawsuit about Google Books, where they're saying, well, you know, we got to sort of copy the stuff first so we can find books better and, you know, do all these things and just provide snippets. You know, it's a lot of the same logic is there, except that, you know, I think in this case, probably the students have an even better case than people who just have web pages out there, or, you know, where they have the expectation that search engines are going to come along and sort of copy their stuff. In fact, a lot of people want that, so they're visible. But students, you know, these papers are sort of personal things. They might not be particularly happy with, you know, how their term paper came out, and all of a sudden it's going to go sit in some database in perpetuity. I think they've got a great case. I think they're going to win.
Yeah, I think they might. Do either of you guys know how this thing actually performs, and like how it deals with things like quotations?
I mean,
how does it distinguish between, legitimate copying, because there is a difference between copying and plagiarism. And Joseph Riegel, who has a blog which we'll put in the show notes, he had an article, a blog post about this week, that there's a difference between legitimate copying, for instance, in a quotation, and plagiarism. And how does, I mean, does the algorithm deal pretty effectively with that?
It does. I just this morning, since we were going to talk about this, I looked at some papers my students turned in over the weekend, and when you look in your inbox, it gives you a list of all the papers turned in, ranked either according to the student's last name or according to the suspiciousness of the paper. And so the paper that was at the top of the questionable list said, the report says 36% of the content of the paper is questionable in some way. So you pull the paper up, and then it gives you two choices, two buttons to click on. One is exclude quotations, and the other is exclude bibliography. And if you exclude those two, I did on this particular paper, I excluded those two things, and then there were two sentences in the whole paper that looked questionable. And those, I looked at those, and those are kind of normal random sentences that probably show up in a bunch of papers because anybody would have written those sentences. So therefore, then the paper is fine. So you can set your preferences to exclude everything that's quoted, and then that, so it then it tells you right away whether the paper seems fully suspicious, one you need to spend some more time on or not.
And do they provide links to websites or things like that where they know it's been copied from?
Everything that is identified as questionable, there is a direct link to the website that it came from or to a paper in their database. And if you ask for the paper that's in their database, you have to write, it sends an email message to the instructor who that paper was submitted to, and then that instructor decides whether to send you a copy or not.
But
So
isn't the
Turnitin
instructor, it's not the
Turnitin
student.
does not send you the paper. The
Right.
instructor to whom that paper was submitted sends the paper.
Right, but I mean, isn't the holder of the copyright is the student, right?
I think this is what's going to be decided in court, whether the student writing the paper is the copyright holder or the institution to whom the school or the college to whom the paper was submitted is the copyright holder.
And I mean, I guess this is an older issue with PhD students and other students having to submit their dissertations to UMI and things. I mean, it's a requirement for PhD candidates at most universities to submit their dissertations to these republication services. It's required by the university, but in fact, the copyright is held by the student.
But at least
There's
in
a
those
lot of cases,
these
issues.
yeah, I mean, but we all had to sign, I remember signing the legal document of the rights away. I wasn't happy with it, and it's often sprung on you, right when you're submitting your dissertation, and what are you going to do? But I think in this case, you've got a lot of K-12 students who aren't knowledgeable, can't read a legal document about this,
No, and can't legally sign a
and they
legal
can't
document.
legal, exactly, they're minors. So it seems really bizarre, and my understanding of the copyright law is anything they produce, it's theirs. I mean, they don't even have to put a copyright notice on it. So I think they've got a very, very good case. Although I assume that they've got lawyers who are quite greedy about this, and it's probably going to be a fairly ugly process. But there you have it. We also saw this week, speaking of more interesting things going on, or less legal things going on. Another round of the digital humanities startup grants came out. I think there were about 15 or so that were funded, and we'll also link to those from our show notes. But did the two of you see any trends or interesting projects that you look forward to seeing that came out of these grants?
Well, I was one of the panelists for a portion of the decision-making process on this, so I know a few of these projects, but there were several panels because there were so many submissions. I think that there are some interesting things in here, in the list of the stuff that's been funded, and it's very interesting to me, having read some subset of the total submitted, to see which ones were funded and which ones weren't. I think maybe one of the most interesting ones is, from my perspective, is coming from the University of Virginia, from the folks at the Institute for Advanced Technology and the Humanities. Mm-hmm.
Is this
Martin.
The one that's led by Joanna Drucker or another?
No, this is the one by Worthy Martin.
Oh, by Worthy. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's the brief statement says, to support development of a tool to present the progression of interrelated items held in an electronic thematic humanities repository. And it's really a sort of data mining project to begin looking at some of these massive humanities databases and figure out ways to make sense of the information that's there. And so, and I remember from looking at the proposal in the first place that it's really a startup grant in the sense that
right.
they're trying to think about the ways that they would go about this and then hopefully use this money to do that sort of startup work and then from there apply for the sort of serious money that it would take to do this in the right way.
Right. I think right. that
and it seems like knowing Worthy's work, he's the right person to start thinking about this.
Yeah.
Or one of the right people to start thinking about this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad that there are these new grants, and I think one of the challenges about these grants for those that have gotten them is it's that process, as you know, we know very well here at the center from having done a lot of grant funded work. It takes a considerable amount of, there's all this process of getting your project from a kind of startup phase really into the next phase. So moving from this startup area up through, you know, a very major digital project, there's a lot of things that need to get learned and, you know, everything from legal questions to marketing to design to programming to hiring people. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's very challenging to fire on all cylinders for all these different skills. And I think one of the things that probably would be helpful to happen is for projects that come out of this digital humanities initiatives that are in the startup grant pool, it'd be helpful for those of them that do, you know, have some success to kind of roll up into a larger format, transition out of that kind of startup phase where, you know, you're not hiring a full-time programmer for a year, which would, you know, easily top the $30,000 that's available. But for them to have some process that you can kind of move from a startup grant up through the ranks of these larger grant cycles, I think would be incredibly helpful, even if it's only just advice on, you know, these are the kinds of things you would need. Because, you know, I'd like to see a very wide array of scholars get these grants, and mm-hmm. I assume a lot of them won't be in, you know, great places like where Worthy works and Joanna Drucker, where they have the real expertise and a kind of standing crew of programmers, database administrators, et cetera, tech-savvy people at the Institute for the Advanced Technology and the Humanities. You know, a lot of people aren't going to be at that kind of a place. And I noticed that there were some independent scholars here. There were people at universities where I know there isn't a digital humanities center. So they're really building these things from scratch. And I think really a nice next phase would be, you know, how do you transition, you know, build up from one of these starter grants into something more major? You know, how do you do that? How do you get the infrastructure in place? How do you deal with all those questions, because there are just so many that come up for these projects.
Right. I mean, to some extent, these should be grants to write a grant. I mean, it can, just from our experience, I mean, it can cost, I mean, I've never done the calculations, but I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the grant proposals, you know, that are put together cost $30,000 and, you know, putting together mock-ups and staff time and in research and I mean, it can cost, especially for digital projects, it can cost a lot of money just to get a good fundable grant proposal together.
And that was really the, you know, the elephant in the room the day that we were reviewing the projects for the panel that I was on, was, okay, so we fund these and we're really happy that the NEH is providing this money and we think it's a really laudable program, but then where's the rest of the money going to come from? And you know, for some of these projects anticipate some very substantial work down the line, and who's going to provide the $300,000, the $500,000, the $800,000 necessary to realize the potential of these projects? And that's, you know, that was our unanswered question that day.
Right.
And it's
Did the guidelines in any way have applicants estimate what the ultimate project costs would be, or was that left out?
No, that was left out, but the applicants did have to at least lay out some kind of a plan for future funding. I mean, they couldn't just say, And after we've spent this $30,000, we anticipate applying for other grants. I mean, they had to have an actual plan of some sort for how they were going to go forward. But as to exactly who those people were, often it was left unknown because it is unknown where that kind of money might come from.
Sure. Well, I think we'll have to keep track on some of these projects. I'd love to hear also where the projects that were funded in the fall, right? Mills, there was another set, the first set that was funded in the fall. It would be great to kind of see where they've gone and what they've produced. Maybe we'll try to delve into that and maybe even bring on some of the project directors on a future podcast.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there for the news roundup and head into our featured story. Today on the podcast, our featured story is about the scholarly cyber infrastructure. And this is, I think, a word that you're going to hear more and more. The American Council of Learned Societies just came out with a report with that title on, I think it's called, actually, the title of the report is called Our Cultural Commonwealth. But the subtitle is The Report of the ACLS Commission on Cyber Infrastructure for the Humanities and Social Sciences. And I think it's really a big topic right now of organizations like the ACLS, big private foundations like the Mellon Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation and other foundations are really looking into how to build up this cyber infrastructure. And actually, if you really want to be in the know, which I think listeners of this podcast, of course, being part of the in crowd, you can now call it CI. I just went to a meeting up in Princeton of Mellon grantees, and that's what people were calling it, CI, or cyber infrastructure. Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful. But I think, first of all, let me just read what cyber infrastructure is from the ACLS report. It says that the term cyber infrastructure is meant to denote the layer of information, expertise, standards, policies, tools, and services that are shared broadly across communities of inquiry, but developed for specific scholarly purposes. Cyber infrastructure is something more specific than the network itself, but is something more general than a tool or a resource developed for a particular project, range of projects, or even more broadly, for a particular discipline. So, for example, digital history collections and the collaborative environments in which to explore and analyze them from multiple disciplinary perspectives might be considered cyber infrastructure, whereas fiber optic cables and storage area networks or basic communications protocols would fall below the line for cyber infrastructure. So I think what people are trying to get at here, and it's something that we discussed at this meeting last week, is really how to enable the scholarly process, the process of doing scholarship, in an age where we have very sophisticated networks, databases, collections, tools, standards. How do we kind of knit all that together, I think, is really the big trend that's going on right now. So I think the way you can think about it is, I think it's much like the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web, the protocols, the servers, the web browser itself, all these tools gel together to create, I think, something larger than all of its individual pieces. And of course, the individual pieces were around before the web. I mean, you had the internet and you had mainframes and all of these things. But, you know, there weren't these kind of specific tools that really brought it together and made it so useful for millions or hundreds of millions of people. And I think what they're trying to get at is, you know, what are the tools, what are the resources, many of which will come out of specific scholarly practices. So I think of, in our case, we have our Zotero project at the Center for History and New Media, which is a end user tool. It's a tool used by scholars to collect, gather and collect and analyze and cite resources that they find on the web or even off the web. That's a specific tool that we really desired as historians, that we thought we needed, and we built that. But you can see already in our work on Zotero how it integrates in with the web, how it integrates with scholarly databases, and it sort of creates a cyber infrastructure, or CI, that really helps scholars do their work. And so I think we're really here at the beginning of this wave of trying to build a scholarly cyber infrastructure, that is, one that has certain certain aspects, certain kinds of information being traded, certain kinds of standards, and certain kinds of tools that are really oriented specifically toward academia. And I think what we wanted to discuss today for our featured story is, you know, where are we, where we can go with this, and sort of what's missing. And I can tell you, without getting into the specifics of the meeting, you know, as we were joking up in Princeton, you know, what goes on in Princeton stays in Princeton. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but you know, I think that a lot of the projects up there are at all ends of the spectrum. So it was really a fascinating series of projects that were presented, and they range from everything all the way down to these really low layers of the academic networks of you know, data that's floating around and services that are floating around at a low level at the university, things like student services of you know, databases that hold information about students or professors, courseware, all these things bubbling all the way up to the actual end user and tools like Zotero. And there's just all this kinds of interaction that are happening between these various layers. And I think we have a tremendous amount of work to do to kind of link these things together. And I thought really what came out of the meeting that, you know, my takeaway for at least the production of this cyber infrastructure for scholarly work is that I think, first of all, there needs to be a lot of work done on in terms of interoperability. And I think, you know, I think we're used to using tools like an EndNote, which is, you know, what Zotero is trying to be a lot better than. But, you know, you think about EndNote is a kind of silo or dead end for your research. You kind of grab stuff and put it in there. It runs on your desktop. It's a kind of, it's an application that is for you alone, but it doesn't link well into a lot of this burgeoning cyber infrastructure. There is some stuff on the web where little buttons appear that say, you know, import this item into your EndNote collection. But if you think about that in the reverse, it's not very easy to then export out of your EndNote into different formats that would be available to other users on the web to share your collection, to integrate it into courseware like Blackboard or Sakai, to automatically produce RSS feeds of bibliographies, all these other things that's sort of happening around the web in different, you know, these new Web 2.0 sites that we've talked about a little bit here on the podcast. They're not happening as much or yet in the scholarly realm. And so I think there's going to be a lot of work on interoperability. I also think things like policies and services that we share, these also need a lot of fine tuning. I mean, things like open access to collections are really kind of up in the air. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of work to be done in this area. And indeed, the ACLS report, which we'll link to from our show notes, has, I think, some really terrific suggestions. And I think it's something that Mills and Tom, we can discuss right now. I think, you know, the first one is you know, show what the value of this is, because it is such a, you know, daunting thing. Mm-hmm. And have the two of you heard of this before, or the term cyber infrastructure? And would you know how to describe it in 25 words or less if someone asked you on the street?
Well, I've heard the term, and I've heard it used, and you know some of the people who served on the commission, but I think that the describing it in 25 words or less is difficult. And I think, you know, I mean, I think we can tell just from the term cyber infrastructure that, you know, the Cyber Infrastructure Commission was thinking about this for a long time and had their own struggles in defining it. I mean, cyber is not a word we use so much anymore, probably haven't used since the late 90s so much. And I think it is a kind of difficult thing to get, even for somebody working in the field, a difficult thing to get your head around.
Right.
In a way, I like what you were saying. Second, Dan, talking about things like interoperability. I think that's an easier thing for me to get my head around.
Right.
Like, how can we make things interoperable? That seems to be more of a mission statement to me than building cyber infrastructure. Although I guess some people need to be thinking about the bigger picture. But for me, if I can contribute to tools and to resources that promote and extend interoperability, that seems to me to be something that I can more easily get my head around.
Yeah. I mean, the interoperability, it relates, I mean, they're all interconnected, but I think the policies and the state of what's currently out there in terms of infrastructure, you know, it's really hard to get these pieces to work together. I mean, there's scholarly tools and websites and so forth that are in public databases, and there's a lot that is going on in sort of the private sector. And in fact, the ACLS report, you know, the first two or three objects say, you know, making the cyber infrastructure a strategic priority, developing institutional policies that foster openness and access, and promote cooperation between the public and private sectors. That seems like you know, a tall order right there. I mean, what we have to do is to show the way in which these things, you know, can really make a difference to even to the kind of commercial stakeholders here. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be done there in terms of just policy and working together.
Yeah, I want to pick up on another piece in addition to the interoperability, which I think is really central, is early on in that ACLS definition was the question of expertise. And, you know, this is in some ways the softest piece of the whole thing because we don't know exactly what that means yet. But something that's been troubling me for a long, I guess, 3-4 years now is how little money is being spent in the humanities to develop that kind of expertise. I mean, you know, if you look at our center, all of us developed our expertise kind of on the fly because we wanted to, not because it was part of some degree program somewhere. And still, in history, George Mason is the only place where doctoral students are required to have some sort of expertise in digital media before they graduate. And there, you know, around the country now, a few graduate courses in digital media for historians, but nothing else comprehensive. I mean, Indiana is starting to try to put something together, and I suspect Nebraska probably will before too long with Will Thomas there, but there's still just not much investment in the development of this kind of expertise, so we're reliant on the entrepreneurs, the historians who learn PHP and MySQL,
right,
or you know, the poet who learns Python or something like that. And
yeah,
and that's not an effective way to build a cyber infrastructure. If that's
right.
What we
well, I think
it.
This is definitely at this stage, I think that's a great point, Mills. I think a big problem right now is that a lot of this is kind of supply side discussion rather than demand side. You know, the ACLS report points out, you know, one of their 8 points is to encourage digital scholarship. And, you know, I think part of the big problem right now is there's not a lot of professors out there who kind of know about cyber infrastructure, care about cyber infrastructure, know what it would do for them, and have the kind of scholarly methods that would enable them to kind of take advantage of this stuff. And so there's not, you know, graduate students and professors, you know, staging a sit-in at the president's office at their university for cyber infrastructure. And so, again, I think it's going to take a real effort to kind of build up some of this stuff from a kind of supply side so that when it gets completely built out, scholars will instantly recognize, oh, yeah, this has tremendous advantage to me. And I think, you know, there are little pieces here that really do help. You know, our friends who listen to this podcast who are in the library world, you know, they're working on all kinds of interesting things to enable auto-discovery of materials in digital collections and to make the, you know, that online library catalog work better with other systems both within the university and outside. So there are great projects going on to sort of integrate Google Scholar or other, you know, commercial sites in with, you know, your standard library lookup sites. You can kind of get a full view of what's out there on your research topic. And so there's little efforts here and there to expose what could really happen if cyber infrastructure all clicks together. But right now, you know, there's not a kind of coordinated effort. And I think it really needs to be, you know, I think a lot more money and kind of visibility has to happen here for there to be, you know, more in the way of demand for it also from, you know, from the faculty.
And, well, I think go ahead, Tom.
I think the other part of this is, and I think Dan's right, you're right to say that the library world has to some extent done a lot more than the scholarly world, than the university community. A big part of this is that kind of cyber infrastructure work, contributing to the cyber infrastructure, building it, is valued more highly, I think, in the library community. I think until things like guidelines for promotion and tenure change in the university, there are going to be a limited number of people working on cyber infrastructure projects, contributing to the infrastructure. I just think, you know, if it's not valued by your peer community, it's going to be hard to get people to do the work.
Yeah, well, I mean, that feeds right into what I was going to say, which is until such time as the leading scholars at leading graduate programs start demanding from their PhD students that these students have some level of digital expertise, and start demanding from their deans and provosts that there be money to teach their students that kind of expertise, it's all of this work in cyber infrastructure is going to be dependent on individuals deciding, wow, I should do this.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think just a little bit of marketing here would kind of help out, because there are cases right now. I mean, just thinking of, say, something like Google Books or the Open Content Alliance, where scholars can say, you know, can see. I mean, when I was doing final revisions on my book, you know, I was able to look up books that I normally would have had to have gone to, you know, one of just a very few libraries that would have a copy of this. And it just happened to be that Google Books had digitized it. And I said, oh, this is great. You know, it saved me a whole trip to go check some reference in some obscure Victorian book. And then, you know, there are cases of search or federated search of being able to, for instance, in the another database that I used for my research, but Cornell houses a distributed, I think along with University of Michigan and a couple of other libraries, a federated search of mathematics books that have been digitized. So I work in the history of mathematics. This is great. You know, I'm able to all of a sudden search across sites and find things that I might not have found otherwise. So I think there needs to be some use cases. I think foregrounded that someone could say, ah, you know, that's really what it's about. If we have those you know, these technologies, and they don't need to hear about the specific, you know, acronyms like OAI PMH, which is what, you know, Cornell uses. So, you know, this federated search technology, they don't need to know about that, but they need to know, oh, this is helping my research in this specific way. I think really you'd start to see some light bulbs go on over people's heads.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Dan, is in without asking you to reveal the secrets of Princeton, was there much discussion about the nature of this project as being scholarly, meaning therefore exclusive of the public? Because, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about lately is in this Web 2.0 world, that there's this melding of expertise and the crowd and to produce some kind of new information. I mean, was there much discussion of that?
Yeah, I think there was. And I think, you know, the agreement that a lot of people came to on this is that I think a lot of what's been missing in Web 2.0 tools is a lack of kind of coming at it from a scholarly perspective. I think inevitably, you know, when we talk about open standards and tools that interoperate, we are talking about, you know, tools that inevitably will be picked up by, you know, those unwashed masses outside of the ivory tower. But I think what people were talking about was the way in which we think about these sort of infrastructural tools and standards as scholars is a little bit different than what's going on outside of academia. Let me just give you one quick example that I was sort of promoting. You know, you think about the difference between Delicious, which I'm sure a lot of our users use, which is the or a lot of our listeners use, which is the social bookmarking tool. And Delicious, right, allows you to bookmark these web pages. And what is it concerned with? It's concerned with the URL. That's the basic currency of a tool like Delicious. But for the Zotero project, here at the center, we focused on, you know, what is our unit? It's the actual semantic object of the book or the article that's mentioned on the web page. So we've really focused on that. And when you focus on that, you know, because that's what we care about as scholars, right? We don't care about some long string of, you know, that you would see in the URL, but we care about, you know, okay, this page on that library is about this letter or this article. And if I find it in my library and you find it in your library, we want to be able to talk about that same article. It's the article we care about, not the web page. And so that emphasis in a scholarly tool on objects like a book or an article, rather than on the URL, which is the currency of the web and a lot of Web 2.0 tools, that really changes the way the tool works. And so when we launch the Zotero server, we're going to be having, you know, people are going to be exchanging information about these objects rather than web pages. And I think that opens up a whole range of possibilities, which absolutely will be, I think, of interest to people outside of the academy, but is very different than, say, what's going on right now with Delicious.
I think there's a, you know, one of the interesting things, I think when you have these conversations, a term that comes up a lot is something like open standards. And I think there's almost an inherent conflict or an inherent difficulty in that phrase, open standards. Things like Web 2.0 technologies like YouTube and Delicious and all of these things, they're very open, but they're not at all standardized.
Mm-hmm.
And then and oftentimes the things that are very standardized are very closed and underused because they
right.
require a certain amount of rigor. I mean, the reason people use Delicious is it's so easy to use.
Right.
You know, you can tag something in a second, whereas even with something like Zotero, it takes a little more work. And I think scholars are willing to do that kind of work, but you're always then limiting yourself to kind of a smaller community. So there's kind of this tension between openness and standardization. And for interoperability, you really need both of those things. It's hard to get both.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, what's been so strange is that you know, universities, libraries, they have been holding all this incredibly structured, well-formed data or information about their holdings. And that integration, I mean, I think what's really interesting about the next 5 years is the integration of that incredibly well-vetted, professional, expert knowledge with the kind of wild web and how you bridge those two areas. I think, Mills, I'm glad you raised this question. I think, you know, it is kind of a clash in attitudes and styles. And also, you know, we need to think more as scholars about the persistence of what we produce in these environments, whereas, you know, people using some of these Web 2.0 tools, they don't kind of care if it goes out of business in a year. But, you know, we care if our research is lost or we need to have certain things in place for us to feel confidence about those tools. So I think really where this cyber infrastructure is going is thinking about that, you know, how do you bring all these, you know, very structured and yes, you know, in a lot of cases, very conservative technologies from the university or that run the university, how do you get them up into today's, digital world, which often is a little bit too fly by night, a little bit too unstructured, in the name of ease of use, of adoption, et cetera. So I think it'll be interesting to follow this as it gets built out.
Well, and it will also be, you know, a complicating factor, and I'm sure you guys probably talked about this a little bit, is that, you know, so much of that on-campus cyber infrastructure is governed by various licenses and corporate agreements and partnerships and all of that. And so it's, you know, it's difficult for universities, especially one like ours, which lacks a lot of resources, to figure out how to join in that kind of merging of information, because that's going to cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind when talking about cyber infrastructure is I think we really need to include a larger swath of the cultural heritage in this discussion. It would be a shame if we ended up with sort of haves and have-nots in terms of cyber infrastructure. And one part of the cultural heritage that I'm thinking of here that is either being left out or just hasn't joined the discussion for whatever reason is the museum community. You know, a huge part of humanities work is done in museums, and in the work that we've done at CH&M with a variety of museums, it's really remarkable how far behind museums are when compared with certainly with libraries and even with university universities and individual scholars. I think the people who are concerned with cyber infrastructure and concerned with building it out really need to work harder to include those other areas of the cultural heritage.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. I would encourage listeners to the podcast to take a look at this report. It's been out for a while now, but I don't think it's really gotten as much notice as it should have. And I think we'll continue to discuss pieces of this as they come online, both from the public and the private sectors. Well, it's time once again at the end of our podcast to have a quick round-the-table discussion of sites, links, resources that we think might be of interest to our listeners. Why don't we start with Mills today?
My site is swivel.com, which is a data sharing website for data geeks like me, and it's a place where you can upload spreadsheets of information and then share them in the same way that Flickr shares photographs. You can comment on other people's data, you can manipulate the graphs of those data, and have all sorts of fun with the information that's there. This is a site that's only in its preview phase. It's not even in beta mode yet, but they already have 4,200 users who've uploaded more than 3,200 data sets. So I see it as a really interesting site for people doing any kind of quantitative history or quantitative social science analysis to begin sharing their data.
And can you overlay the data on top of, you know, data from one person and another person?
That's part of their plan. It's not there yet.
Okay. Great. Tom, what do you have this week?
I've got a site called LibriVox, and it's a free audiobook site, and it's produced all by volunteer labor. People can volunteer to read the text of public domain works, and they've got about 500 open free audiobooks that you can download and put on your iPod and listen on your way to work. Pretty heavy on 19th century, obviously, because it's all public domain stuff, but 19th century English literature. But they've got works in, it looks like, 7 or 8 different languages. And they've got novels, and they've got scientific texts, and they've got a whole bunch of stuff. So it's definitely worth a browse.
Yeah, it's a great site. I've used that just to do some books on tape for traveling, and you know, some of the readers that they have, because it's totally open, so anyone can read some of the chapters, and some of the people are actually very good, and then others are a little bit less good. But and then sometimes you have the discordance of one chapter is read by one person and the next chapter is read by someone else, and but it's a terrific site, and they have so much up there, so I think it's a great alternative to, I guess, audible.com or buying something on iTunes. I think it's a great site. I haven't used this chance at the end of the podcast to plug some of our own stuff at CH&M, but we just had a major release or upgrade to Zotero, which I've already mentioned a couple of times in the podcast, so I might as well flog it a little bit more here before we leave. The big addition, if you haven't gone to Zotero.org, Zotero.org, and picked up our research tool for the Firefox web browser, the big thing that we added is a new annotation and highlighting mode, which really gives you a full-fledged desktop environment for not only grabbing your materials off the web that you want to do research on, but then also annotating, highlighting, adding little stickies to it. It's a really terrific mode that you can use. And there's just hundreds of other upgrades that we've made and bug fixes. So if you haven't downloaded Zotero yet and you're listening to this podcast, quickly pause the podcast and go over to Zotero.org, press the download button, because I'm sure you're already using Firefox 2.0, and you'll be all set, and you can check out those new features as you may. So thanks once again. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot,
Mills.
Man.
Good talking with the two of you. And again, Tom can be found at foundhistory.org. Mills, it's good talking with you again. And Mills can be found at edwired.org. And I'm Dan Cohen, and I can be found on my blog at dancohen.org. We'll be back again in 2 weeks for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.